This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Podcast of Audio Reading Service volunteers reading the Journal Gazette is provided by the Allen County Public Library for the sight and print impaired and made available with the permission and cooperation of the Journal Gazette.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Cindy with
Erin.
And for the next 2 hours, we will be reading selections from the Saturday, October 4th, weekend edition of the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette, copyright 2025. We begin with the news for the first 40 minutes. After the news, we'll read area death notices until complete and then take a short break. When we come back from the break, we'll read a number of features from the living section, including horoscopes and advice columns. After that, we'll read perspectives, including editorials and letters to the editor. After the editorials, we'll read TV listings, sports, and birthday announcements. The headlines from the front page of the Saturday, October 4th, weekend edition of the Journal Gazette are: City wants to team up for homeless, man guilty of murder in 23 case, federal funding vote fails again, and Trump orders Israel to stop bombing Gaza. And now here's Erin with the first article.
Federal funding vote fails again. Hopes for a quick end to the government shutdown faded Friday as Democrats refused to budge in a Senate vote and President Donald Trump readied plans to unleash layoffs and cuts across the federal government. On the third day of the shutdown, another Senate vote to advance a Republican bill that would reopen the government failed on a 54-44 tally, well short of the 60 needed to end a filibuster and pass the legislation. Meanwhile, House Speaker Mike Johnson announced that the chamber would close for the legislative business next week, a move meant to force the Senate to work with the government funding bill that has been passed by the House Republicans. Following the failed vote, senators quickly headed for the exits of the Capitol, expecting no more votes over the weekend and showing few signs of any real progress towards ending the congressional standoff. Instead, both sides dug in for a prolonged shutdown fight that thrusts federal workers into more uncertainty, threatens to ripple into the broader economy, and gives the Trump administration an opportunity to reshape the federal government. I don't know how many times you're going to give them a chance to vote no, Senate Majority Leader John Thune said at a news conference Friday. After the vote, he said he was flying home to South Dakota for the weekend, adding, "I'll be available." The vote showed hardening lines in the Senate. The same three members of the Democratic caucus, Senators Catherine Cortez Masto, John Fetterman, and Angus King, who voted for the funding bill previously, did so again. And Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky was once again the only Republican opposed. "They thought they could bludgeon us and threaten us and scare us. It ain't working," said Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer. Democrats are demanding that Congress extend health care benefits, while Republicans are refusing to commit to anything until the government is reopened. They are trying to wear Democrats down to vote for a House-passed bill that would reopen the government temporarily, mostly at current spending levels. Although Republicans control the White House and both chambers of Congress, the Senate's filibuster rules make it necessary for the government funding legislation to gain support from at least 60 of the 100 senators. That's given Democrats a rare opportunity to use their 47 seats to hold out in exchange for policy concessions. The party has chosen to rally on the issue of health care, believing it could be key to their path back to power in Washington. Their primary demand is that Congress extend tax credits that were boosted during the COVID-19 pandemic for health care plans offered under marketplaces set up under the Affordable Care Act, former President Barack Obama's signature health care law. Everyone is about to experience dramatically increased payments, dramatically increased premiums, co-pays, and deductibles because of the Republican health care crisis. Everyone, warned House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries during a news conference on Friday. Democrats are running the high-risk strategy of effectively voting for a government shutdown to make their stand. Trump has vowed to make it as painful as possible for them. The Republican president has called the government funding lapse an unprecedented opportunity to make vast cuts to federal agencies and potentially lay off federal workers, rather than the typical practice of furloughing them. Trump shared a social media video Thursday night that depicted White House Budget Director Russ Vought as a grim reaper. Vought has already announced that he is withholding billions of dollars for infrastructure projects in states with Democratic senators. And on Friday morning, he said he would withhold another $2.1 billion for Chicago infrastructure projects to extend its train system to the city's south side. Democratic leaders have displayed no signs of budging under those threats. The cruelty that they might unleash on everyday Americans using the pretense of a shutdown is only going to backfire against them, Jeffries said during an interview with the Associated Press and other outlets at the Capitol Thursday evening. Still, the shutdown, no matter how long it lasts, could have far-reaching effects on the economy.
Man guilty of murder in 2023 case, also convicted of drug counts, victim discovered in vacant lot. A 33-year-old man faces up to 176 years in prison after jurors Friday found him guilty of several charges, including murder and dealing drugs related to a 2023 homicide. Cedric A. Williams, 33, was found guilty of all charges, murder, two counts of dealing in a narcotic drug, dealing in methamphetamine, unlawful possession of a firearm by a serious violent felon, and resisting law enforcement, along with sentencing enhancement for using a gun to commit a crime. Chief Deputy Prosecutor Tom Chale said, jurors deliberated for more than 6 hours before delivering the verdicts. Allen Superior Court Judge David Zent then dismissed the unlawful possession of a firearm charge, according to online court records. Williams was charged after Vanessa Brabson, 34, was found dead in a vacant lot near the St. Mary's River nearly 2 years ago. 2 days later, her 33-year-old husband, Sean Brabson, was killed after a shooting in an alley near Lenox Avenue. Both died of multiple gunshot wounds, according to the Allen County Coroner's Office. Williams was accused of killing Vanessa Brabson. James L. Saylor, 35, who is Vanessa's brother, was charged for his brother-in-law's homicide. Saylor was sentenced in September 2024 to 80 years in prison after he was found guilty of murder and a sentencing enhancement. Williams was charged with murder after investigators found cell phone data for the woman and the defendant that placed them in similar locations before her death. They were both at Williams' home about an hour before they went to the parking lot where she was found dead. Witnesses confirmed that they were at the home. One said they saw him give narcotics to Vanessa, but she did not give him anything in return. The cell phone data showed that the last transaction on the victim's phone was Williams calling. Her phone then went off the network, according to court documents. Police tried to initiate a traffic stop with Williams 2 days after the homicide, and the defendant fled on foot. Police found a sandwich baggie with several other bags inside near where Williams was walking before he was arrested. Those bags contained more than 22 grams of cocaine substance, 15 grams of methamphetamine, 6.4 grams of marijuana, and about an ounce of fentanyl in various forms, the affidavit said. They also found about $278, a digital scale used to weigh drugs, and a 9mm handgun. This is Williams' third murder case since 2020. He was charged with the 2020 homicide of 40-year-old Marlon Kimbrough, who was found dead with a gunshot wounds along railroad tracks. His first case related to Kimbrough's death was dismissed because of the unavailability of a witness. Those charges were filed again in 2023, and the 2024 trial ended with a hung jury who couldn't agree on his possible guilt. Prosecutors refiled those charges December 2024. His second trial in that case is scheduled to begin January 6th in Allen Superior Court. For Vanessa Brabson's death, Zent is expected to sentence Williams at 8:30 a.m. on November 3rd.
City wants to team up for homeless. Fort Wayne officials are seeking a nonprofit to operate a new homeless services center that will offer a low-barrier 24/7 shelter and a safe parking area for people living in their vehicles. Mayor Sharon Tucker has said, addressing homelessness has been a goal of hers, and this will provide services not currently offered in Allen County. Fort Wayne has shelters that serve varying populations, such as men or women and children, but many options have barriers, such as requirements for clean criminal records and sobriety, that prevent people from using the services. Amanda Fall, the city's homeless services manager, has said the official point in time count of individuals facing homelessness in 2024 was 417, but she estimates more than 2,250 people are affected. The Homeless Services Center would be owned by the city and operated by the successful nonprofit applicant. City officials are searching for a building to renovate for those uses, a news release said. By purchasing the building, putting out the request for proposal, we're making sure that this is happening as quickly as possible, Fall said. A cost for the project is not yet known, she said. Funding sources to buy and renovate the building are also undetermined, but the city will pursue federal housing dollars, the news release said. The city wants to include a 24/7 shelter primarily for men and women that will have access to food, showers, laundry, phone service, and secure storage, among other amenities. The center is also expected to have safe parking with designated parking spaces for people living in their vehicles, the news release said. The center will also include other entities, such as other nonprofits that provide wraparound services. The center will coordinate with other shelters, such as the Rescue Mission, so services are complementary instead of duplicated, Fall said. Our community doesn't offer all the services needed to address the complex issue of homelessness, and there is no organization equipped to fill these gaps alone, Tucker said in a statement. That's why the City of Fort Wayne is stepping up to lead an innovative partnership of the public, nonprofit, and private sectors to offer results-oriented and compassionate services that prioritize safety and paths to permanent housing. The chosen nonprofit will work to get people using the center into the city's coordinated entry list that connects them to wraparound services such as job training, mental health services, health care, and basic needs such as food and housing. We know that permanent housing is the long-term goal for everyone, and so we really want to have that sense of urgency first and foremost, Fall said. There may be other stops along the way on that journey, such as drug and alcohol treatment, or they may get connected to a shelter, but regardless, if they're in that building, they are going to have a housing action plan, because we want to help move people to permanent housing. Some elected officials, including City Councilman Russ Yale, Republican of the 2nd District, have urged the city to act on homelessness. Yale has said the perception is Fort Wayne is no longer safe. The administration's request for proposal constructively advances the discussion how the city can humanely and effectively address homelessness, Yale said Friday in a statement. I look forward to further studying its potential funding and how it will fit within a stronger, larger strategy that balances services and enforcement. The deadline for proposals is 5 p.m. December 5th. The full request for proposal is available online at engage.cityoffortwayne.org/Operation Homeless Services Center Request Proposals.
Trump orders Israel to stop bombing Gaza as Hamas partially accepts peace plan. U.S. President Donald Trump on Friday ordered Israel to stop bombing the Gaza Strip after Hamas said it accepted some of the elements of his plan to end the nearly two-year war and return all remaining hostages taken in the October 7, 2023 attack. Hamas said it was willing to release the hostages and hand over power to other Palestinians, but that other aspects of the plan require further consultations among Palestinians. Senior Hamas officials suggested there were still major disagreements that required further negotiations. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel was prepared for the implementation of the first stage of Trump's plan, apparently referring to the release of hostages. But his office said in a statement that Israel was committed to ending the war based on principles it has set out before, without addressing potential gaps with Hamas. Trump welcomed the Hamas statement, saying, "I believe they are ready for a lasting peace." Israel must immediately stop the bombing of Gaza so that we can get the hostages out safely and quickly. Right now, it's far too dangerous to do that. We are already in discussions on details to be worked out, he wrote on social media. Hamas said aspects of the proposal touching on the future of the Gaza Strip and Palestinian rights should be decided on the basis of a unanimous Palestinian stance reached with other factions and based on international law. The statement also made no mention of Hamas disarming, a key Israeli demand included in Trump's proposal. Trump appears keen to deliver on pledges to end the war and return dozens of hostages ahead of the second anniversary of the attack on Tuesday.
Civic Theater chief to retire in June after 25 years. When Fort Wayne Civic Theater With Fort Wayne Civic Theater on firm financial footing and a move back to the renovated Arch United Center just months away, executive/artistic director Philip Kohlglaser is preparing to leave the role he has held for a quarter of a century. The organization's board announced Kohlglaser's retirement in a news release Friday. His last day will be June 30th. Kohlglaser told the Journal-Gazette that he didn't want to leave until Civic Theater was well on its feet. "I really wanted to make sure that I left them in a good shape and not leave them stranded during this transition so that they could get back home settled before I retired," he said. Civic has been operating out of a pair of buildings in Foster Park Plaza on Bluffton Road since its vacated Arts United Center in spring 2024, ahead of a $41.5 million modernization project at the performing arts venue. Most of the Civic's operations will return to the center, which has a public reopening celebration scheduled for October 25th. Civic's costume shop and some storage will be located in a nearby building. Civic is expected to move its offices back to Arch United Center in December after its production of Disney's Frozen from November 8th to 23rd, which is the first full-scale production slated for Arch United Center after its reopening. It will be the final show Kohlglaser will direct before his retirement. When Kohlglaser was hired in 2000, Civic Theater was $90,000 in debt, according to the news release. He worked with the board to bring the organization back to a balanced budget within 2 years. During his tenure, Civic's endowment has grown from $10,000 to $3.5 million. Kohlglaser's passion for theater began with the Civic in 1975 when he was cast in South Pacific at 15. He obtained a theater degree from Ball State University and performed overseas before returning to Fort Wayne in 1989 to perform and work for Fort Wayne Ballet. He also portrayed Happy the Hobo for several years on Fox 55's Happy's Place children's program. A 7-member search committee is accepting resumes for the executive/artistic director position through December 1st. Director of Marketing Capri Williams said Civic has posted the position nationally. Among qualifications listed in a 5-page job description at fwcivic.org/employment is minimum of 7 years experience working in theater with additional nonprofit management experience. The new hire is expected to start June 1st, according to Williams. Kohlglaser's exit is bittersweet, she said, because she will miss his leadership and creativity. "I've learned so much from him, not only as a creative, but also as a professional," Williams said. "I feel very lucky to have been a part of his career in some capacity. Not being from this community, but feeling like I'm part of it now, I know that the community is going to miss him greatly, especially Civic Theater," she continued. Kohlglaser said he hopes the new executive will bring in a fresh energy and a focus on change for the organization as it approaches its 100th anniversary in the 2027-28 season. He believes the groundwork has been laid for a growth spurt with initiatives such as the Fort Wayne Civic Theater Conservatory Education Program, Project Lights Up, sensory-friendly performances, and implementing universal design in shows for greater accessibility. But as for what he will do in retirement, Cole Glazer said he hasn't given it much thought. For me right now, my focus has been on completing my contract and making sure it's a smooth transition, he said.
Southwest Allen County Schools looking into Warsaw's elementary programs. Southwest Allen County Schools' proposal to embrace choice is about more than opening its classrooms to more non-resident students. The district also wants to expand opportunities for students district-wide. The plan could bring elementary signature programming, such as dual language immersion, nature-based education, and a fine arts focus for the district's youngest learners, Superintendent Joshua St. John said. Warsaw Community Schools in Kosciuszko County has found success in creating such themes for its 8 elementary buildings, Superintendent David Hofford said. 2 buildings provide Leader in Me program that helps students develop leadership skills and positive habits, and 2 others offer dual language immersion. Participating students spend half their school day with a Spanish-speaking teacher and the other half with the partner English-speaking teacher. Warsaw's other elementary schools are STEM certified by the state. STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. The themes have helped Warsaw, which allows in-district transfers and accepts non-resident students. Sustained enrollment, Hofer said. The state statistics show the school system had about 6,700 learners last academic year, or about 3% less than 15 years ago.
And in some news briefs, parkway dedicated to fallen officer. A memorial parkway near Memorial Coliseum was dedicated Friday to Sergeant Dan D. Edenfeld, who died in the line of duty in 1998. Officials and his family gathered for the ceremony Friday. They unveiled the Sergeant Dan D. Edenfeld Memorial Parkway sign on Parnell Avenue and then walked to the Coliseum's Memorial Hall for a ceremony. Edenfeld died May 15th, 1998, of a heart attack after a foot chase with an intoxicated subject involved in domestic violence, according to the Officer Down Memorial Page website. Edenfeld, 49, was working security at the Coliseum when he saw the assault. The 26-year veteran deputy of the Allen County Sheriff's Department died while undergoing surgery. He was survived by his wife and 2 children. Kendallville gets loan for lead pipes. The city of Kendallville has secured a $5 million low-interest loan through the State Revolving Fund Loan Program that it will allow residents to have lead service lines replaced at no cost. The lead service line replacement program was instituted by the state, Mayor Lance Waters said in an email. The city of Kendallville doesn't have lead in its lines, but this will be used for the lines that connect the system to their homes. That being said, it is an opportunity to utilize state funding to help improve the quality of our citizens' lives and infrastructure, he said. Kendallville will save about $8.9 million in principal and interest compared with using open market financing, the Indiana Finance Authority, the loan administrator, said in a news release. The program is funded by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the state of Indiana. To learn more about the SRF program, visit srf.in.gov. And Braun appoints 3 from region. Governor Mike Braun recently made several appointments to boards and commissions, including 3 Northeast Indiana residents. Troy Hellman of Coldwell Banker Real Estate Group in Allen County will serve on the Indiana Gaming Commission with a term expiring September 30th, 2029. Rick James of the James Foundation in DeKalb County will serve on the Arts Commission with a term expiring June 30th, 2028. And Jesse Haft of Huntington County will serve on the Board of Registration for Soil Scientists with a term expiring June 30th, 2027.
1,000-foot setback for solar adopted. At least 1,000 feet must separate solar developments from non-consenting properties and the centers of roads, a move some say will deter those types of developments from moving to Allen County. The Allen County Commissioner's unanimous decision Friday followed the Allen County Plan Commission's recommendation that solar fields be built 400 feet from non-consenting properties and 200 feet from the center line of the road. The commissioners in August amended that recommendation to 1,000 feet for both. Dave Schaub, senior planner of the Development of Planning Services, said that was what staff originally recommended after years of research. The Plan Commission voted down those amendments last month, but as the elected body, the commissioners had the final say. Trina Rodebush, senior government affairs associate with EDP Renewables North America, said the ordinance will make developing solar projects in the county, including one proposed for outside New Haven, more difficult. Flat Rock Creek Solar Park is planned 100 megawatt site that is expected to generate about $34 million in tax revenue and be in operation for 35 to 40 years on 700 acres. Now, she said, plans will have to change. I feel like with the really extreme setbacks, it was intended to prohibit development, and it likely will, she said. What could happen if the project changes form a bit? It may spread out and result in impacting additional neighbors and impacting additional acres of land. Solar ordinances vary across northeast Indiana counties. Adams and Noble counties require a 300-foot setback, and Wells County solar developments must be 200 feet from non-consenting property lines and the center of roads. Some require more space. Huntington County's setbacks match the new Allen County standard. Whitley County requires even more space with 1,500-foot setbacks. Rodebush said EDP has no interest in developing solar projects in Huntington or Whitley counties. It's a clear sign that the solar development is not wanted, she said. Developers have to make decisions of where to deploy resources, human capital, etc., and this would generally be enough to deter investment.
SACS seeking more students. 4 years of declining enrollment has Southwest Allen County schools ready to make a change. Numerous factors, including lower birth rates, an aging population, and private schools, have contributed to the loss of more than 500 students since fall 2021, when enrollment peaked at nearly 7,800 learners, officials have said. Other public schools are also chipping away at Southwest Allen's enrollment, which is tied to the district's state funding. The number of SACS residents attending another district or charter school increased to 310 last fall, 105% more than the 151 who did 3 years previously, according to the state's public corporation transfer report. SACS, which has generally restricted enrollment to residents and children of employees, is considering a strategy districts including Fort Wayne Community Schools use to maintain or increase enrollment. Superintendent Joshua St. John will recommend a policy change during Tuesday's board meeting that would allow more non-residents to attend its 9 brick-and-mortar schools beginning next academic year. The board is expected to vote October 21st. The district online school, ESACS, already permits enrollment of non-resident students. St. John announced the possible policy change in August when introducing a plan that supports SACS's desire to be the district of choice, a distinction measured by enrollment and educational opportunities. The proposal also includes loosening restrictions for in-district transfers, which are currently limited to compelling educational or medical reasons. The adjustments wouldn't make classes larger. Rather, SACS has said the change would fill open seats. It's too early to know how many non-residents the district might accept and where. Factors including in-district transfer would affect openings. This would be very carefully managed by us, kind of like a faucet that we would open or close and control the flow of over time, based on our capabilities, St. John told the board last month. In Indiana, public school state funding is tied to enrollment, so every student gain or lost affects their budget for items directly tied to infrastructure. That includes teachers' guidance counselors, instructional assistants, principals, classroom materials, and academic programs. Along with losing students to fellow public schools, many districts were further affected last fall by the 75,000 Hoosiers who attended private schools through the state's Choice Scholarship Program, which gives families vouchers for private K-12 tuition. About 12,000 Northeast Indiana students opted for such schooling, including about 6,300 Fort Wayne Community Schools residents and about 1,800 East Allen County school residents, according to the transfer report. School officials are open about the financial benefits of accepting non-resident students. We can no longer afford to be a well-kept secret that relies on students in the surrounding neighborhoods for enrollment, said Stockman, the FWCS spokeswoman. The state funds students in K-12 the same no matter where they live, so attracting students from outside our boundaries is one way to maintain or increase enrollment. Resident families ultimately benefit, said Wang Likowski, the EACS administrator. Maximizing and sustaining enrollment allows the district to better stabilize funding and avoid staff reductions or school consolidations, especially during periods of otherwise reduced resident enrollment, she said by email. Having the funding to improve schools further increases the reputation and appeal of the school district and facilitates positive public perception and relationships between the school district and its stakeholders. Districts don't necessarily bring in more students than they lose to other public schools, however. FWCS and EACS are among the 16 Northeast Indiana districts that last fall sustained a net public transfer loss, about 1,800 and 300 students, respectively. FWCS has about 30,000 students, and EACS has about 10,000. Bluffton-Harrison Metropolitan School District and Wells County is among those that consistently have a net gain of more than 100 students. The school system last fall enrolled 370 students living in 11 corporations in Adams, Allen, Blackford, Grant, Huntington, Jay, and Wells counties. About 200 Bluffton-Harrison students attended another public school. Superintendent Brad Yates said the positive transfer trend reflects the value families see in the district's education. We offer a wide range of high-quality programs comparable to those in larger districts while maintaining the feel of a small school where all faculty and staff prioritize supporting every student as individuals, Yates said in a statement. We believe families choose BHMSD not because of any specific marketing efforts, but because of the strong programming, personal attention, and sense of community we provide.
Police video released of Michigan church attack. Police responding to a mass shooting at a Michigan church quickly encountered the gunman and killed him after repeatedly demanding, "Drop the gun, drop it now," according to body cam video released Friday. A 47-second video was released by police 5 days after the four people were killed inside the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Grand Blanc Township near Flint. The gunman, Thomas Jake Sanford, also died. Chief William Rene praised the very courageous actions of a state conservation officer and another local officer who ran to the sounds of gunfire. This is what law enforcement is trained to do, and this is how law enforcement should respond to these incidents, he said. The video shows only brief images from outside the chapel. Renouet did not release video showing the police near Stanford after he was killed, saying he was mindful that the Sanford family also has suffered. The video shows police yelling, "Drop the gun, drop the gun, drop it now." One of the officers tells the other officers, "I've got your back, shoot him." Renouet said at least 8 shots were fired at Sanford. He said the incident lasted less than 4 minutes from the time of the first 911 call, not 8 as first reported. Sanford had rammed his pickup into the chapel, repeatedly firing shots and setting the building on fire last Sunday. Besides the deaths, 8 people were injured. Sanford's friend said he had repeatedly expressed hatred for the Mormon Church, as it is commonly called. 4 white crosses with blue hearts were set down in the street from the ruins of the church property. Each cross has the name of someone who died: Craig Hayden, William Pat Howard, John Bond, and Thelma Armstrong. Flower bouquets were placed there and votive candles burned Friday.
And in some news briefs, Apple removes app to track ICE anonymously. Apple has taken down an app that uses crowdsourcing to flag sightings of U.S. immigration agents after coming under pressure from the Trump administration. ICE Block, any phone-only app that lets users anonymously report and monitor activity by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, officers, is no longer available on Apple's App Store. ICE Block and other crowdsourcing apps like it are being targeted, but crowdsourced technology has become common in the App Store. Navigation apps like Waze or Google Maps for Android phones have been in use for years. Part of their draw is that users are alerted to police speed traps by other drivers. Neither of those apps has been targeted by U.S. officials. Graystar, other firm, settle rent suit for $141 million. Graystar and 25 other property management companies have agreed to pay over $141 million to settle a class action lawsuit. The lawsuit accuses them of using rent-setting algorithms from RealPage to drive up housing costs. Graystar, the largest apartment owner in the U.S., would pay $50 million under the proposed settlement. The agreement, filed Wednesday in a Tennessee federal court, still needs a judge's approval. The companies have also agreed to stop sharing non-public information with RealPage. All involved denied wrongdoing, but will assist in the Department of Justice ongoing case against RealPage and other firms. Cyber attack hits major Japanese beverage producer. A major Japanese beverage producer has been hit by a cyber attack this week, which has disrupted shipments and operations. ASHI Group Holdings said its computer systems were attacked on Monday, affecting orders, shipments, and a customer call center. A company spokeswoman said Friday that the issue remains unresolved, though some emergency shipments were made on Wednesday. The cause and motive of the attack are still under investigation. Overseas systems were not affected. It's unclear when the system will be fully restored. Some Japanese media reports suggest ransomware, but ASHI declined to comment.
And more briefs. Kavanaugh plotter gets 8-year sentence. A California resident who attempted to assassinate U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh at his Maryland home was sentenced Friday to over 8 years in prison by a federal judge who imposed a punishment significantly more lenient than the Justice Department's recommendation. Sophie Roesk, a transgender woman charged under her legal name Nicholas Roesk, had faced a maximum sentence of life in prison. Prosecutors had asked for a prison sentence of no less than 30 years, which was the low end of the range recommended by the sentencing guidelines. Roesk, then 26, had a pistol, a knife, zip ties, and burglary tools in her possession when a taxi dropped her off outside Kavanaugh's home in Chevy Chase, Maryland, just after 1 a.m. on June 8, 2022. Noticing guards outside the resident, Roesk kept walking down the street, then dialed 911, reporting having suicidal and homicidal thoughts, and said she needed psychiatric help. The U.S. District Judge Deborah Boardman described Roesk's conduct as reprehensible, but credited her with abandoning the plot before police detected her presence in Kavanaugh's neighborhood. Attorney General Pam Bondi said the Justice Department will appeal the woefully insufficient sentence. Trump scraps NYC law enforcement cuts. President Donald Trump said Friday he has reversed $187 million in funding cuts made by his administration for New York's law enforcement and counterterrorism operations following bipartisan outcry from New York officials. The reversal came after Democrat Governor Kathy Hochul sent a letter to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noemi on the Monday railing against the cut, saying they represented 86% of Homeland Security funding to the state, impacting the New York City Police and Fire Departments, state police, and other law enforcement agencies. Bail change after NC train stabbed OK. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein signed into law on Friday a criminal justice measure that the state's Republican-controlled legislature approved in response to the stabbing death of a Ukrainian refugee on a Charlotte commuter train, even as the Democrat said he opposed some provisions and wished others had been included. The new law bars cashless bail for certain violent crimes and for many repeat offenders. It also limits the discretion magistrates and judges have in making pretrial release decisions, gives the state chief justice the ability to suspend magistrates, and seeks to ensure with more defendants undergo mental health evaluations. And last, Yom Kippur attack victim shot by police. One of the two Jewish men killed in a car and knife attack on a synagogue in the English city of Manchester appears to have been accidentally shot by a police officer, according to detectives who said Friday that the attacker may have been motivated by Islamic extremism. Police said congregant Adrian Dalby, 53, and security guard Melvin Kravitz, 66, died trying to prevent Thursday's attack on the Heaton Park Congregation Synagogue on Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar. Three other people were hospitalized in serious condition. Police shot and killed a suspect 7 minutes after he rammed a car into pedestrians outside the synagogue and then attacked them with a knife in what the police force called an act of terrorism. He wore what appeared to be an explosives belt, which was found to be fake.
Target rolls out self-checkout kiosks to help customers with vision issues. Target is rolling out new self-checkout kiosks designed for blind and low-vision shoppers, and the retailer isn't keeping the technology to itself. The Minneapolis-based company says the first-of-its-kind stations are now in 200 stores and will expand to all locations by early 2026. Target has chosen not to patent the tactile controller it's co-developed with Elo, which manufactures touchscreens for retailers and other companies. The retailer had the fifth most patents of Minnesota companies in 2024. Target worked with the National Federation of the Blind during the machine's development, design, and testing. Their feedback, along with other blind community members, directly shaped the technology, according to the news release. The features, such as high-contrast button icons, a headphone jack with adjustable volume control, and physical navigation buttons are common among devices designed for people who are blind or have low vision. But the touchscreen has streamlined use of the functions to better meet the needs of the blind and low-vision community. The technology will be added to existing kiosks, and all self-checkout stations will be accessible, a Target spokeswoman confirmed.